This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 127th in a series of monthly interviews with security gurus, and I am super pleased to have today with me Marie Moe. Hi, Marie.
Hello, Gary.
Professor Marie Moe is a security researcher at SINTEF in Trondheim, Norway, and an associate professor at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. She's been a team leader at NorCERT, the Norwegian National CERT, and has taught security classes at Gjøvik University College. Marie's recent work focuses on public safety and security systems that may impact human life. Lately, Marie's become quite renowned in medical device security, since her own life depends on a pacemaker. Dr. Moe has a PhD in information security from NTNU, as well as a MSc degree in mathematics. She lives in Trondheim, Norway with her family. So thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You are both a teacher and a researcher, and I think you've taught university courses, I assume, to undergrads and grad students, and you do security research now for SINTEF. So which is more fun?
I think both teaching and doing the research is fun. And of course, also, I've been so lucky to get out there and talk to a lot of people and to go to conferences. And yeah, I like both the, talking about my research, doing the research, and teaching future generation of security researchers. So I think everything is equally important, actually.
I knew you were going to say that. What courses are you teaching or have you taught that you've really enjoyed?
So I've been responsible for one course, which is on incident response and preparedness planning. I've been teaching this for 3 years, and it's also going to go this spring semester at the NTNU. Mm-hmm. Gjøvik University College has been merged with the bigger NTNU, so that's why some courses are changing, and it seems like this will be the last time that I give this course in this form, but it's going to continue as a more specialized course for master students in incident response.
Gotcha. I remember visiting Gjøvik. It was really fun. I guess the campuses are not really the same, huh?
Yeah, Gjøvik is smaller than the bigger NTNU campus. It's like 2 hours train ride from Oslo mm-hmm. to get to Gjøvik. So mm-hmm. it was easy when I lived in Gjøvik, but after I moved, I didn't live in Gjøvik, I lived in Oslo for a couple of years while I worked at NorCERT. But now when I live in Trondheim, it's quite a journey to get there.
Yeah, I remember riding a bus in Norway, which actually had Wi-Fi, and I was like, so if buses in Norway can have Wi-Fi, why can't airplanes have Wi-Fi?
Yeah, I know that bus.
And this was years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, we're pretty, advanced in Norway when it comes to adopting technology.
Absolutely. So tell us how the lab at SINTEF works and what kind of work you do there.
Yeah, so I started at SINTEF 1.5 years ago. And SINTEF is an independent research institute. It's the biggest one in Scandinavia, actually, with 2,000 employees.
Wow.
And my institute is focused on ICT research, and we're doing contracted research for businesses, companies, and also for the government or for public sector in Norway. And there's a small percentage that is funded directly from the Norwegian state. But usually we have to compete for the funding of our projects. So since I started, I've been involved in a lot of application writing
yep.
to fund to research projects.
I know those days. I started my career that way a million years ago at what was called then Reliable Software Technologies on soft money, writing grants for the government and inventing technology. It's pretty fun, but it's a lot of work. What work are you most proud of that you're doing now at SINTEF, you know, outside of the grant writing procedures?
Yeah, I'm really proud of this project that I'm sort of initiated myself and that I've started working on, which is the pacemaker security project.
Yep.
It actually started as a hobby project of mine a year ago. I was asked to give a keynote talk at the HackLU, a yep. hacker conference in Luxembourg.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was preparing this talk, the talk was supposed to be about how it is to be a security researcher and depending on a medical implant, a pacemaker.
Yep.
So I have this pacemaker that I've been depending on for 5 years now, since it's correcting my heart rhythm, which was really slow. I actually passed out suddenly because my heart was taking a break. So the pacemaker saved my life. But of course, being a security researcher and getting this implanted medical device, I started to do some research on my own on its security. I had a lot of questions about how this worked and if it could, you know, be, if it could have any security vulnerabilities or if it could be hacked.
Mm-hmm.
And some previous research from 2008 by University of Michigan and Kevin Fu showed that actually it can be hacked.
Yep.
But I wanted to know more about my device, of course, a little bit from my own perspective when I had this device implanted.
Yeah.
And I've been talking to people about this, and then I was asked to do this keynote talk, and I was thinking, what should be my key message of this talk? I'm talking to a room full of hackers. What do I want them to take away from my keynote? And what I really wanted them to do was to be aware of that there are lots of insecure medical devices out there, and we need more attention to this problem, and we need more security research on medical devices. So I wanted to, you know, inspire hackers in the room to pick up on medical devices and start doing research.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was doing or preparing this talk, and I was thinking, I'm a researcher. Why am I not doing this research myself?
Good question.
So I was really, you know, motivated to do this. And I talked to a couple of friends about this. And one of my friends, Aaron Leverett,
mm-hmm.
He agreed to join me in this project as a hobby project.
Yep.
So we just started, you know, 1 year ago, on our spare time doing this, and several other researchers have also donated of their free time to work on the project. But it wasn't really a research project for SINTEF until I started to get a lot of publicity about it.
Aha. So and then they're like, wait, we can, this is good.
Yeah.
Great.
So I got a lot of support from a manager, which has been really great in this. I got accepted to give a talk at CCC last year,
mm-hmm.
In December, which is like the biggest hacker congress in Europe.
Yep.
And I didn't really know what I was, I hadn't been there before. so I just submitted a proposal, you know, and I thought, okay, let's try to see if this works out.
Yeah.
And then I got accepted and I was kind of panicking. Wow, I'm going to talk to this huge crowd
of
hackers about this project. And accidentally there was a Norwegian journalist in the room that picked up on this, and he did a portrait interview with me, and this was published in one of the biggest newspapers in Norway.
Yep.
And of course, this also attracted attention in Norway, and my manager approached me and said, "This your hobby projects, it's really interesting. We want to support you in this." And I got some internal funding to start working on creating a bigger research project, which is actually what I'm doing right now. I'm writing a big grant proposal to try to get some money from the Norwegian Research Council to work more on this.
Outstanding. That's a really great story. So it shows that when you're passionate about something, you can actually turn that into your livelihood if you do it right. So when you first got your pacemaker and the doctors couldn't answer some of the questions you had about the technology and how it worked, that was interesting. Do you think you understand your own pacemaker now better than they do?
Actually, I was admitted to hospital a couple of weeks ago because of a problem with my pacemaker. And after this, I've been into further checkups. And last time, actually last week, I went into the local hospital here in Trondheim. And the doctor who was doing the checkup, he was talking to me as if I was more, you know, of an expert on this than him.
So, well, but are you? I think you probably
at least,
are.
At least on the you know, more technological side, I might be a bit more knowledgeable about some of these things.
So that that calls into question this. So who should approve modern medical devices? Doctors or technologists or security people, or what's the deal? Because doctors don't know anything about technology for the most part, and technologists don't know too much about how the body actually works. So it's a tricky bit. What's your opinion?
We need to, you know, bring together the different stakeholders when it comes to securing medical devices and even further connected medical devices. As in this case, my pacemaker has a functionality that allows it to connect to the internet and be a sort of part of the Internet of Things or medical things. And so we need to include all the stakeholders in working on this. And that means the device makers, of course, but also the security researchers. And then we have the regulators, policymakers, standards bodies, and of course, also the healthcare providers, the physicians, and patients should be included in this too. Because I'm really concerned when I'm doing this. I'm thinking about all the ethical dilemmas too when I'm doing this security work, research. Because if I find some vulnerabilities, I don't want this to create fear among patients, my co-patients.
Yeah. What did you think about the St. Jude's thing that happened not too long ago?
Yeah, that actually I was quite upset when that happened.
Yep.
I felt really emotional when the news came out. I got a lot of people contacting me and wanting me to comment on it.
Yes.
And also, for the first time in my life, I was being subject to a lot of outreach from financial investors.
Right.
Like Wall Street people that contacted me and wanted to have my consultancy on this.
Yep.
So I was kind of overwhelmed for a week.
Interesting.
Before I actually decided to write a piece about this in a blog in Norwegian.
Right.
But my first reaction was that I couldn't really believe that they didn't contact St. Jude Medical with their findings.
Right.
And also that they didn't contact the FDA.
Yeah.
I think that was also very,
Yeah, instead they
seems like they were really financially motivated.
Yeah, they shorted the market instead. So I actually know Justine Bone, and she's usually a reasonable person, but that didn't seem like very reasonable behavior, especially when it comes to the, you know, life critical issues. So I guess that's how you feel too.
Well, I was puzzled by that approach, but when I read the report, I was a little bit calmed down because there was no real details in the report. It was not like they were disclosing 0 days in the pacemakers, because you couldn't really do anything with the details in the report. And also, Kevin Foos' group were looking into some of their claims and actually debunked one of their. They had published a video showing that they allegedly hacked the pacemaker by bricking it.
Right.
And the proof was an error message shown on the pacemaker programmer.
Yep.
But Kevin Foos' group showed that you could actually get the same error message just by interrogating a pacemaker that was not connected to muscle tissue.
Oh, interesting.
That was sort of where their wires were just open to the air.
Yep.
You would also get the same kind of error message.
I see, because sort of wrong conductivity through the loop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they also had a claim that they had an exploit that could deplete the battery of the pacemakers, which
yes.
I think is really a bad scenario.
Yep.
And this week, totally unrelated, there was a recall actually announced by St. Jude for a brand of their implanted cardiac devices.
Yeah.
And that had failed, the battery failed so that the device ceased to deliver therapy.
Right.
And two patients actually died because of this error, of this failure.
Yeah, I mean, that goes to show you how real this stuff is. This is not theory. This is not about philosophy. This is about people's lives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People's lives being, you know, killed potentially by software bugs or errors.
Yep. And we've had safety critical software conversations for quite a long time. But even with the medical devices, remember, if you think about the Therac 25, which was delivered radiation to patients, and it had some setting issues. There are some very famous software bugs over the years, but it seems like we haven't made as much progress as we need to. What's your feeling about that? You know, Kevin Fu did that work in 2008. Have we made some progress since then in the field?
I have a feeling that they have made some progress, which is good. I was invited by the FDA to be on a panel earlier this year in January, where they were presenting their new approaches to, you know, pre-market and post-market risk management of products. So the FDA has started to work on this. Also, the medical device vendors have started to have incident reporting or vulnerability disclosure policies, which I think is a good thing, so that there actually is a place where researchers can contact the companies in case they find vulnerabilities.
Right, yeah.
Because this was lacking previously.
Yeah.
But now they're slowly adopting to this, and they want to be in dialogue with security researchers, which I think is a good thing. They seem to be pretty proactive on this. After I went public with my concerns, I've been contacted by several vendors that wanted to talk to me and be in dialogue about this, which I think is good.
Yeah, so the attitude is right.
Some progress has been made.
Yeah.
That was one thing I was worried about, actually, when it came to this St. Jude and MedSec and Muddy Waters disclosure. How could this affect the collaboration in the future between researchers and vendors?
Right.
Yeah, it's hard to say.
Yeah, well, that brings up a question I wanted to push on a little bit. So this idea that, you know, all you have to do to secure something is hack it and then fix what you find, kind of testing security in, doesn't seem to be right to me. I think you have to design things properly and you have to review code. And it's not just about testing at the end of the life cycle. You know, the idea of, say, running a bug bounty for pacemakers seems really like a bad idea to me. What are your thoughts about that?
I completely agree that you need to build security in, and you're the expert on this. Bug bounties is not the answer, I think, to this. I think there are a lot of things that you should do to be before you get to that point that you're a really mature enough organization to create a bug bounty program.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's not the first thing that medical device vendors need to focus on. I think, as you say, that building security in and having more transparency and more testing, I really would like to see more third-party testing of devices is the way to go.
We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, make sure to check out my other projects on GaryMcGraw.com. There you can find writings, videos, and even original music. So you're on the record as wanting medical device code to be open source. Why?
Well, it doesn't have to be open source. But it has to be some transparency that allows the end users, like patients like me, to trust the product.
Ah, okay.
And one thing that, so of course, you can have open source software, but you can have some other alternatives in case that doesn't work.
Yeah.
For example, a software bill of materials is a good way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Because that means declaring that the vendor needs to declare all the different software that are shipped with the product.
Right.
And this can be a great use, for instance, a great use case for hospitals that get hit by ransomware and they don't really have a good enough overview of all their different products that can be vulnerable to this type of attack.
Right.
So, of course, they need to have their inventory management in place first before they can, identify what needs patching.
Absolutely.
But when they don't know what's in their products, the way it is today, the vendors, they want to control the devices themselves. So they actually tell the hospitals that they need to put holes in the firewalls in order to give them remote access so that they can remote manage their devices.
Mm-hmm.
And the hospitals are actually the ones that have to
decide
take
that
responsibility.
Yeah.
of this.
Yeah.
So there's a problem, you know, with the asymmetric information.
Yeah.
And also the person that decides what security measures to take and what the what type of requirements that they put on the vendors are not the same persons that take the risk in case something goes wrong.
Yeah, there are all sorts of economic imbalances like that. And that's why I'm really pleased to hear your very subtle answer to the question, because I think you're right. You know, if you just open source something, then you have the economic problem of who should pay to secure it. And if somebody pays to secure it, should their work benefit their competitors and so on? It really gets tricky. And I think that pushing it through inventory is a really good idea. One of the things that is of note along those lines is that the way the TAO, you know, the NSA attack guys really work is pretty straightforward from what I can tell from their public statements. They just have a better inventory than their target. And they keep track of, you know, when there are problems in that inventory and they go after it. And so inventory control turns out to be kind of a fundamental aspect of software security. And when you think about scalability, you have to do that first.
Yeah, and then there's also the issue of putting in measures that can be helpful in an investigation.
Mm-hmm.
So today there are not any requirements of forensic capabilities
right.
of medical devices.
Right.
So if something goes wrong, it's up to the vendor what kind of logging they have implemented. So you might get crash logs or you might get nothing.
Right.
Actually have a very good example of this if I'm using myself as an example again.
Yep.
So what happened to me was 3 weeks ago, I was in an airplane on my way to give a talk at a conference in the Netherlands, the hardware.io conference,
yep.
A hardware hacking conference. And while I was up in the air, my pacemaker suddenly failed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty awful.
Yeah, I didn't know what was going on at the time. I just felt a really strange sensation. It was like my heart was beating really hard.
Yeah.
And I could also feel that my muscle, chest muscle, was twitching
uh-huh.
in the like the rhythm of my heart. I could actually see it on my chest.
Wow!
So I notified the the air crew, and when we landed, there was an ambulance waiting for me, and they took me straight to hospital in Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to be debugged in a way. So when they hooked me up to the pacemaker programmer, there was an error message
right.
displayed. And it said that a data error had been detected.
Yeah.
And the pacemaker needed a reset, a reinitialization.
Yeah.
And there was a file created with the memory dump and logs from the event.
Holy cow.
So I think this is really really good thing. Of course, it was a bit problematic that after my pacemaker was reset again, it was back to its factory settings.
Right. So it needed to be reprogrammed with all your settings.
I needed to get it reprogrammed for my settings.
Holy cow.
But luckily, I had a printout from my previous visit at the pacemaker checkup, so we could get my settings back. And next day, I was giving a talk at the conference, so I was good to go after that.
But what's interesting is that there
was actually some files created, and these files have now been sent to the vendor to investigate this issue.
And you survived this because you understand technology, and you had a backup, and you knew what your parameters were. But, you know, frankly, most people don't have that deal of understanding the way that you do.
Yeah, so luckily I detected that something was wrong and I went to the hospital. It was actually a safety function of the pacemaker that got into effect. It switched to a backup mode, which is good because I'm 100% paced, so I'm depending on the pacemaker to work at all times.
Right.
So this this safety mode felt really strange because it was really like it had a higher voltage and so on. So that was what I detected. But of course, if you don't detect that something is wrong, you might go unaware of this and get this, and this can be not good for your health. And I also chatted with the pacemaker technician at the hospital, and he said that some of these devices, they don't give any error message on the screen when things like this happen. So they just have to guess, and they can't really know what's going on.
Wow.
So it's it's a problem to not have the logging and forensic capabilities in place.
So given your own personal experience with these things, and you've explained a couple of aspects of what I'm going to ask, but how can a manufacturer demonstrate to your satisfaction that the medical device they're going to put in your body is secure?
So as I said before, third-party testing would be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
That I'd not have just to, you know, trust that the vendor says it's secure, so it's secure.
Mm-hmm.
But in my case, as a more informed user, I would actually like to see the software myself and do my own third-party testing of this.
That makes sense. What are your views on this kind of emerging software / device certification marketplace?
I think there's use for software certification, and I think that's something that will help to, you know, regulate the device makers and giving them some incentives to create more secure products.
So that's good. I want to switch gears a little bit and ask you something completely different. So do attitudes towards women in security in Norway differ from attitudes in the U.S. as far as you know? Or is it the same deal?
Wow, that was a difficult question. I haven't been that much in the U.S., so I don't know if I can answer that.
Well, maybe just explain how it's like in Norway to be a highly technical woman in an advanced field and doing security work.
Yeah, there are not a lot of women in the security field generally, but actually I know a lot of women in Norway that are working in security, and so maybe it's a little bit better here. In my group here at SINTEF, we are actually 50% women working on security, which I think is exceptional, and that I like that really a lot. Because I like to be in a mixed work environment. I'm used to be one of the few women in the room.
Right.
And it doesn't really bother me that much.
Yeah.
Sometimes it can actually be to my advantage because I get noticed, you know, people remember me.
Right.
But at the same time, you need to make a good impression because if you do something wrong, then it's like every woman is not good at the thing because every is not good at it. I think that's a really common feeling. In Norway, at Gjøvik, actually, there is a conference yearly conference being held by NORCIS, which is focused on women and security.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, I think they have only women speakers in this conference usually,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of women attending, which I think is great because this creates a community and people get to know each other. So it's kind of a networking event for women in security in Norway.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's the answer for everything, but at least for students and people starting out in the field, I think that's a good place to go to not feel like you're always standing out in the crowd.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
You would if you go to normal security conferences.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks. And then the last question, which has nothing to do with anything at all. Which establishment makes the best cocktails in Trondheim, in your opinion?
Which establishment?
Sure.
Well, you're planning on going to Trondheim in the future?
I've been to Trondheim a couple times.
Yeah, actually, I would recommend a cocktail bar / restaurant called Nordøst or Northeast.
Uh-huh.
I think they have really good cocktails.
Okay, you heard it here first. Thanks. This has been really interesting, Marie. Thanks for your time.
Hey, thanks.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The July-August issue of IEEE S&P includes articles on verifiable electronic voting and breaking down barriers between security and business. The issue includes our interview with Marty Hellman, inventor of public key cryptography and recent Turing Award winner. While you're there, make sure to watch the video we produced to celebrate the 120th episode of Silver Bullet. 10 years, holy cow. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.